To the sixth annual BCLT Privacy Lecture. I'm Robert Barr, Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. I'll make a few quick announcements and then introduce Professor Schwartz and get started. So, announcements. CLE credits, sign up all the way in the back or at the table? Sign up there for the record if you want CLE credit for today. Bathrooms are down the stairs as you come in the front door. Or as you head back to the front door, the stairs down there, and the wireless is open, right? That's the announcements. So without further ado, I'll introduce Professor Schwartz, who is professor of law at Bold and co-director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. Professor Schwartz is a leading international expert on information privacy and information law. His scholarship focuses on how the law has sought to regulate and shape information technology, as well as the impact of information technology on law and democracy. His recent articles include The PII Problem, Privacy and a New Concept of Personally Identifiable Information, Regulating Governmental Data Mining in the United States and Germany, Constitutional Courts, the State, and New Technology, and Prosser's Privacy and the German Right of Personality are four privacy torts better than one unitary concept. In addition to teaching privacy here at Bold, there at Bold, he teaches torts. He is also co-author of a casebook on information privacy law and a treatise on privacy law fundamentals. The new, I guess, second edition, Paul, is just out, and we encourage you to get a copy. It's a very useful handbook on privacy law. He has testified before Congress and served as an advisor to the Commission of the European Union and other international organizations, and he also assists numerous corporations and law firms with regulatory policy and governance issues relating to information privacy. So, Paul, take it away.
Thank you very much, Robert. It's my great pleasure to moderate this panel today, and I'll tell you a little bit about all three of our participants, and then Joel will start. So and I'll also tell you about how this event kind of should work and why each of the speakers is here. And so Joel Rydenberg is professor of law and director of the Center on Law and Information Policy at Fordham University, where he's Stanley D. and Nikki Waxberg chair. He's an expert on information technology, law, and policy. He's very widely published. He's testified before the U.S. Congress on data privacy issues. And I guess what I would say about Joel and his contribution here is that he is an expert in EU privacy law. And we have worked together in the past, and we work together in the present, and we'll be working together in the future. And Joel and I, actually, we were just talking about this, go back to 1992 when we first met because a mutual friend of ours who was on his faculty spoke to both of us and said, you know, there's somebody else who does this strange field that you're in. What is it, database protection? Mm-hmm. And they would say, well, no, database protection is really part of copyright law. And we do something called information privacy or data protection, and Marty was already not listening to us. And he said, well, there's someone else, don't worry. And you should meet him because you'd probably have a lot to talk about with each other. And so it's, of course, very gratifying to Joel and to me to see how much our field has grown since then. So there's not just two people doing it. So our next speaker, after Joel does the main presentation, our first commentator will be Andrew Bradford, who's professor of law at Columbia Law School and co-director of Columbia's Center for European Legal Studies, where her research focuses on international economic law, EU law, and comparative and international antitrust law. She is an advisor. She's been an advisor on economic policy in the Parliament of Finland and has worked as an expert assistant to a member of the European Parliament. So Anu is here today as a generalist EU law expert. So for those of us who are in the privacy field, we know a lot about EU privacy law, but if we have to get involved in EU law, it quickly becomes quite daunting. And for me, and it's kind of a timely analogy, it must be what it's like if you try to figure out what's going on in the Vatican. that it's extremely impenetrable from an outsider. You know, you're looking for the white smoke or the black smoke from Brussels, and that's about the best you can do. So Anu actually understands European law. And then we'll be hearing from Kurt Wimmer of Covington and Burling, and Kurt is truly one of the leaders of the privacy bar in the United States and the international privacy bar. He's the U.S. chair of the firm's global privacy and data security practice and a partner concentrated in privacy and technology law. He represents clients on privacy and public policy matters before the FTC, the Federal Communications Commission, Congress, and the European Commission. From 2000 to 2003, he focused on European data protection law in Covington's London office. So from Kurt, we're hoping to get the practitioner's perspective on Jill's presentation. So that's my introduction, and now we'll hear from Professor Reidenberg.
Thank you, Paul. It's a true delight to be here this afternoon, and I'd like to thank also the Center for hosting this, and Anu and Kurt for responding, and Google for sponsoring. It's a lot of fun to be here because, you know, Paul was just mentioning that we go back many years in the privacy field, and we used to always tease, Paul was my big brother. And in the privacy field, no pun intended on that. He was really there, ahead of me, thinking about some of these issues. So anything I know and do, I always look up to my big brother for these sorts of things. And for today's talk, Paul had suggested that I do something on data retention. And most of my work has been in the private sector field. So I thought, it'd be pretty interesting to try to take a look at data retention. It turned out to be a lot more daunting, I guess, than I perhaps first anticipated, not really knowing what I'd get into and learning a lot about what Big Brother actually is doing. So my starting point for the talk, I wanted to try to link data retention and data access together, because I think they're two sides of the same coin. I don't think you can look at one without the other. And the talk today is really going to start with a couple of premises before I get into the discussion. The first is that privacy is a real pillar for democracy, that we look to privacy to protect citizens against state intrusions. And that's the same whether in the United States or in Europe. In the United States, we see it in the Constitution. We see it in the Bill of Rights. In Europe, it's found today in the Charter on Fundamental Rights for the European Union. It's found in the European Convention on Human Rights. In Europe, they call it private life. The protection is for private life, but it's interpreted as privacy in a similar way to our constitutional understanding. The second premise that we see is that both in the United States and Europe, or I'd say certainly over the last decade, we have been increasing the ability of public authorities to access communications data. And by communications data, I'm referring essentially to traffic data, online traffic information, sort of who you're interacting with, time, log files, and geolocation data. My talk today actually will really be focusing just on those aspects, on the communications-related data. And we see that this increase in access tends to be justified on both sides of the Atlantic as a protection for public safety. And public safety, it's necessary if you're going to have liberty and freedom. So it's these access efforts are linked to the protection of liberty and freedom. So in taking a look at how these are brought together, I'm going to run through three different aspects. The first is really just to talk about what some of the basic rules are. The systemic differences between the U.S. and Europe and how we treat data retention and data access. I think in each instance, the way we and the way the Europeans treat it derive in part from different models of democratic governance that we have. The second is then to look at some intractable conflicts. we tend to see on both sides of the Atlantic a divorce between the discussions on retention on the one hand and discussions on access on the other. And we see burden shifting between the private sector and state authorities in policing, in costs, a whole host of things that I'll call these intractable conflicts right now. And they lead us to what I think is a very crucial turning point for privacy. We see, and I'll try to show, that we reverse a number of democratic values in the way both the U.S. and the European legal regimes have addressed access and retention. So simple things like the presumption of innocence gets turned on its head, the way access and retention laws have evolved over the last decade or so. So let me start with the United States. What does it look like in the U.S.? We have, to my knowledge, only one rule that requires data retention of communications data in the U.S. It is a regulation that is for telecommunications. It's an obscure rule in our telecoms regulation that says phone carriers have to keep toll records for 18 months so that they can resolve billing disputes. I think that's the only rule in the U.S. that mandates data retention. It's not surprising. In the United States, we tend to look at the market as addressing our privacy needs. Our regulation tends to focus on transparency of the marketplace, disclosure, notice, choice. We don't look to the state to protect individual rights, unlike in Europe where the state is seen as a protector of rights. So when we translate that in retention, we've got nothing there. Corporate practice, on the other hand, it's the reverse. We do have a very profound corporate practice in the United States to retain data and retain massive amounts of transactional data. So we hear the buzz phrase big data today. That's what's driving it. It's collect data to be able to analyze it, to use it for all sorts of purposes. So it's a practice, not a legal requirement. In Europe, on the other hand, it's a very complex picture. Europe has three main European-level instruments that address data retention. And by European instruments, these are known as directives. Directive is adopted by the European communities in these cases. This is pre-EU as we know it today. And the directive requires each member state to enact conforming national legislation. So I'm going to talk mostly just about the directive rather than specific member state law. The starting point is a directive from 1995. This is the framework directive on data protection. We use the word privacy. Europeans use the word data protection. The framework directive has a limitation on data retention. Data is not permitted to be stored any longer than is necessary to fulfill the purpose for which the data was collected. So it's a storage limitation. It has no sectoral specificity. It's a general rule applicable across the board. It was seen in Europe at the time that there would be sectoral rights fleshing this out a little bit, elaborating what the general framework directive requires. So in 1992, 7 years later, we see a sectoral rule for the telecommunications sector, and that's Directive 202/58/EC. It's known as the e-privacy directive. So this applies to telecommunications. It says that data is to be purged once the transmissions are completed. Right, think about what the telecom world looked like 10 years ago. Very different from what it looks like today. It had some exceptions from that purging requirement. In other words, again, it's an anti-retention rule, just like the directive. The U.S., by the way, has no anti-retention rule either. It's just silent. American law is silent on it. The exceptions in the e-privacy directive are for certain marketing uses, for subscriber billing, and then for payment, if you needed to hold on to it to assure payment. Each of these two directives, the General Data Protection Directive and the e-privacy directive, were inapplicable to law enforcement. The rules didn't apply to law enforcement purposes because at the time under the Maastricht Treaty, which was the EU treaty, at the EU level, the EU did not have legal competence over the criminal justice system. That was left purely to the member states. That begins to change. Now, under the Lisbon Treaty, it is no longer that way. In 2006, we see a very different kind of directive come down. And this is a post 9/11 directive. And this is a data retention directive. It's a mandate that data actually be held and stored. The other two were limitations on storage. This one requires it. It was pushed by the Interior Ministries. The requirement is that data, the transaction data, be kept for 6 to 24 months. And it's up to the member state law to make those decisions. Exactly how that's done, how long, whether it's the 6 month, the 24 month, or any place in between. And note, this is a derogation from the framework. The framework says you only keep it as long as it's necessary. The retention directive says you have to keep it for at least 6 to 24 months for law enforcement purposes. So these are the basic rules for retention. Well, what's the other side of the coin look like? Here we want to look at access. Now, the U.S., in contrast to what we do on retention, where we have almost nothing, we've got a lot on access. We focus much more on limiting access. So we have the Fourth Amendment. Right? The Fourth Amendment protects reasonable expectations of privacy. Very important. You need a warrant if you're going to infringe on that. On the other hand, we have something called the third-party doctrine. This derives from the U.S. versus Miller case, which means that if you disclose information to a third party, you've given up your reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to the government. So for purposes of traffic data and communications data, the third-party doctrine basically means the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. The constitutional protection isn't there. Of course, there's a little bit of a problem because the traffic data can, in fact, be revealing and disclosing content, information about content, which would have at least a stronger claim to constitutional overprotection. We actually see this quite pronounced in two Supreme Court cases. One is an old chestnut under the Freedom of Information Act. It's the Reporters Committee case, where the court recognized that even discrete publicly available information, if combined together, presented a whole different picture and could be invasive of privacy if disclosed. And more recently, in the U.S. v. Jones case last year, Justice Sotomayor and a number of the justices recognized that aggregations of transaction data, geolocation, over a period of time could be very informative of what people were thinking and doing, much more like content data. So we have, for the purposes, our general purposes of traffic information, very little constitutional doctrine one can hang one's hat on to restrict access. On the other hand, we have ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, a statute that is more than 25 years old now. It was drafted at a time when, again, communications looked radically different from what it looks like today. And ECPA sets out a whole bunch of wonderful standards. Some things need a warrant. If you want content information, email messages stored less than 180 days, you need a warrant. You can get a subpoena for other kinds of information. And then other information, transaction data, can be obtained just through an administrative subpoena. Much lower standard of proof. And it ranges, you know, probable cause for a warrant, articulable facts that show likelihood for a subpoena, and almost nothing for an administrative subpoena. So we have a regime in the U.S. that focuses on setting up parameters for access. Likewise, in the EU, we see, through these three directives, a series of provisions associated with access. But the directives themselves do not spell out access rules with any particularity. The first two, because they had no competence over criminal justice, couldn't touch it. The very first directive, the framework directive, Directive 9546EC, limits disclosure of personal information if the purpose is not compatible with the original reason it was collected. So in a sense, that's a restraint on access. You can't get, if I hold the data, I can't give access to anyone for a purpose other than that for which I collected it in the first place. As far as public authorities go, that's still going to be a matter of member state criminal law and criminal procedure law, how access rights by public authorities could get to data held even under the general directive. The 2002 directive gets a little more specific for us. It still needs member state law, but here the directive says that access, you have to provide, the member states have to provide in their national law what they mean by access. And that access has to be what's necessary and proportionate in a democracy to safeguard the public. So the articulation of what's necessary and proportionate is left to the member states. And in 2006, the Data Retention Directive gives us a somewhat more complicated formulation. You need a law if you want to give access to data retained as a result of the retention obligation. That law, you need a law, you need to have procedures. So you need law and procedures. They have to be, they have to fulfill necessity and proportionality requirements of EU law, international law, and the European Convention on Human Rights. So now there's an external constraint on the member states for what they can do in their criminal procedure. And there is some jurisprudence coming out of both the European Court of Justice on what that means in the data context. Well, how do these lead to what I'll call the intractable conflicts? It's worth looking at the context before we delve right in. This is, I put up on the screen the Google Transparency Report that's as of December 12th. And this shows the access requests, user data, this request by governments to get access to user data held by Google. And what do you see? Dramatic increase over the last 3 years. I think it's, 70 or 80%? It's getting close to doubling right now, just over the last 3 years of those increases. Four of the European Union countries, I think, are in the top 10 of access. The United States dwarfs everybody. Then you have India, and then you have top five. Then you have four European countries. So in this sense, I think it's critical for us to begin to think about how retention and access are joined. How are they joined in the European parlance by proportionality, these proportionality limitations? How are they joined in the United States? And then what happens with the apparatus for making these retention and access systems work? They're in conflict. So if I'll start with the linkage between retention and access, I call this an elusive linkage. We saw in the European directives, member states need a law. The law has to fulfill the necessity and proportionality requirements that a democracy needs to give access. What in the world is that going to mean? In Europe, what we've seen throughout is a much greater emphasis on the regulation of retention, but what I'll call very blurry controls on access. Right, those directives don't really spell much out for the member states. The member states that have been trying to implement them they've been implementing the retention side and getting overturned by courts, member state courts, on the way they're implementing retention. So the great example is the constitutional limit in Germany that Paul has written extensively on. Several of the member states, there are two right now that have cases pending before the European Court of Justice about their retention side. But not a lot of attention is being paid to criminal procedure and how the specific access controls are handled. In the U.S., we don't do anything on the retention side. Our emphasis is on the regulation of access. But what we have on the regulation of access, which is striking, is ECPA is seen as a mess. The Steve Jackson Games, it's a Fifth Circuit case, the court writes about ECPA. It's famous, if not infamous, for its lack of clarity. Right, so even the courts can't figure out what ECPA means in terms of providing access rights. Judge Smith, who's a magistrate judge, has written a piece on the orders issued under ECPA. And one of the things that he discovers is he calls ECPA a secret docket.
And he runs through the number of effectively secret orders and orders that no one is in a position to even appeal under ECPA is staggering. So we have this situation, really, where we're not really effectively joining the regulation of retention and access at the same time. If we take a look at the enforcement burdens, we see a very significant contradiction in what takes place here. So how do we see this? The first is we turn the private sector into a sheriff, which essentially means in the United States, for example, we turn the private sector into the instrument of privacy invasions for citizens. How? Well, the private sector, by practice, is holding all of this data. And now we give government the ability to gain access to it. So we put the private sector as being the intermediary for public authorities engaging in law enforcement activity. We're deputizing them to serve in part as a quasi-agent for law enforcement. That's a total reversal of what we usually think about in the United States. In the EU, the same thing happens. The EU requires private organizations to retain data and to give the state access. In Europe, the European democracy model typically looks at the state to protect its citizens. The United States, we grant rights in our Bill of Rights. They're negative rights. We grant the rights to the citizens to protect themselves against the government. Europe does the reverse. Well, this shifting of roles, this shifting of sheriff role, in effect, is reversing the state as the protector for Europeans, because it's now saying the private sector is acting to protect societal interests by retaining all this data that it's going to have to turn over to the state. And at the same time, in the U.S., we're turning our private sector into the state as far as citizens are concerned, engaged in surveillance of those citizens. So we see just a very odd transformative effect on both sides. If we look at contradiction, it's more of a European problem, the contradiction between the 1995 directive that says you don't keep information. The basic fundamental value expressed in that directive is data should be kept no longer than is the minimal necessary to achieve the purpose for which it's collected. And now the retention expands that. Right? It wasn't, if I surf the web, I'm surfing the web. I'm not creating a data stream with my service provider for law enforcement. But now the retention directive says I am. It's statutorily changing that ground rule. There's a proportionality problem or conflict, I think, on each side. The easiest one to see, I think, comes from the European example. So we collect data. We have a retention requirement. The data is there. It becomes a honeypot for all sorts of other activities. It's known as function creep. It's a classic problem in political science. There's a wonderful example from the French law. You have in the French law the data retention requirement. And then just a couple of years ago, they had a new statute on it's the law for confidence in the confidence in the electronic environment. And that statute now says that the retained data can be used to enforce private intellectual property rights. So here, you start out with a regime that's about public safety and a regime that's about protecting democracies because you worry, the interior ministries were worried about 9/11 type events. And now we've moved all the way over to a situation where this data set is being used for private economic enforcement purposes. When we looked at proportionality, you also see in Europe, and I'll use a French example again, proportionality has to be what's necessary to protect public safety. Well, a lot of the national rules were being billed as these are urgent problems. France adopts its implementation of the 2002 directive and then waits 7 years before it enacts a decree making it effective. So evidently there was no urgency in those 7 years. It took them 7 years to come out with a decree. Right. Clearly, there was no urgency to implement what they were so worried about at the very start. So it would be very hard to figure out exactly what proportionality means. And for the courts, it's going to be a very challenging problem. There are cases now before the Court of Justice. They're going to have a very challenging problem to decide, is this really proportional? where you have the police and the law enforcement arguing that people will be killed if we don't have this. We need it, absolutely. If only we had more information, we'd be able to do a better job stopping crime, finding criminals, and so forth. And it's very hard to see what the countervailing force is. So I'll come to the last point, which is why I think we're at this turning point with a rather difficult and challenging dilemma. These systems, in effect, create transparent citizens, which is not something that we like in democracies. Right? The notion of democracy is that you need privacy for an individual to be able to interact effectively in a democratic society. But here we do the reverse. We have large data sets that are required to be retained. Access is now being granted. And in that access, we see one critical feature, which is we reverse the presumption of innocence. How do we do that? Well, in the U.S., we have the Fourth, Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment, all have this underlying theme that citizens are presumed innocent, or innocent until presumed guilty. Data retention presumes everybody's guilty. Right? It's a government order to keep information about you without any suspicion, without any indication that anyone in that data set has done anything wrong. Same presumption exists in EU law. It's in the Charter of Fundamental Rights, Article 48. It has a presumption of innocence. So in each, the U.S. and the European systems, the data retention concept and giving an access is reversing this critical presumption of our democracies. In doing so, I would argue that it reduces our zones of individual freedom. So if we think about individual freedom and the need to have privacy to be able to freely associate with others, right? In First Amendment parlance, it's the associational right that goes along with it. Privacy to be able to think, to be able to judge how we want our interactions revealed or not revealed, making decisions about what we do. That whole zone is shrunken by this retention access regimes, these retention access regimes that have been set in place by democracies on both sides of the Atlantic. And then the second point of this turning point is how we're now what I'll call diffusing state police power. Right, we're enlisting the private sector as very important police agents. That has huge significance, long-term significance. Right? We now have to look over our shoulder. Our organizations that we have in times intimate relationships with, just think of all the browsing you do, you know, when you're sitting in bed, for example. You know, now that organization, anybody that you talk to, can in fact be an agent for the police. They're keeping tabs on you. They're holding on to that data. And they can turn it over with varying degrees of due process to the state, if the state wants it. That gives us very different dynamic in society. I mentioned, you know, we now see that power expanding to private matters. Once it's there, once the data is available, it doesn't take a lot to argue, well, gee, copyright infringement is a statutory violation. I ought to be able to get access to that data to enforce my copyright privilege. And we can see that begin to expand because it's there. And that's a very hard thing to check once the pieces are set in motion. So, where do we go from here? What do we do about it? I'll argue, and I'll close with this, that we really need to couple much more tightly, both in the U.S. and in Europe, notions of retention and access. So in the United States, we have to do the reverse. We haven't regulated retention. The result is we have massive retention with no storage limitations on it. We need to think about undoing that, having limitations on storage duration. And then couple that, we've got to revisit how we deal with access, because we've seen right now the ECPA is a bit of a mess. Europe, on the other hand, has this retention obligation, and they're real fuzzy about their access. And we need a much stricter combination, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic. So on the one hand, it's very clear collection and storage limits. And on the other, it has to be coupled with strict and specific access limits. Because if we don't do that, it will be very difficult, if not impossible, for us to preserve some sense of privacy in ways that are consistent with our democratic values. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. That was magnificent. And now we'll hear from Professor Bradford.
Thank you so much. So thank you, Paul, for inviting me. I am absolutely delighted to be here and feel privileged to be able to offer my remarks to that very insightful lecture. So I will start by commenting specifically on the key claims that Joel is making, really from the point of view of sort of the broader context of the EU law. I will then turn to explaining a little bit more what I think drives the approach that the EU has on privacy, and that helps us explain why the US and EU have adopted such different positions here. And then I will talk about the idea that if the US and the EU differ, why is it that EU in the end carries the day? And it is a descriptive argument and not a normative one. It really is sort of my attempt to unpack that this descriptive logic of how in the world of regulation the EU's approach has come to dominate that. And then eventually move on to discuss that if we don't like that idea, what can we in the United States do about that? So Let me start. I think Joel very insightfully outlines the various challenges and tensions that are now going on in the evolving law of privacy in the EU, and how when he argues that there are these more expansive data retention requirements and at the same time very limited regulation of the conditions under which the public authorities can access that data. And I think he's absolutely right to point out that this does lead to a very unsettling legal situation where we may face the erosion of the privacy rights of the citizens, and very importantly how we see that the monopoly of the state in enforcing these rights is being diffused. So I see there the concern that Joel has, it relates to both the substance and the process. So substance in the sense that I think Joel is very uncomfortable with this idea of the standard that governs now the access to data, namely the principle of proportionality, how that operates. Does it really give us the kind of legal benchmark that we can be comfortable that these trade-offs are adequately being addressed? So the other, and then the concern about process is really that the way to make the access rights real, we need to impose extensive retention requirements to private parties. And this way, the private parties, individuals, corporations, really become the agents of state law enforcement machinery. And this is something where we are privatizing the state surveillance, what we haven't really seen before. So to reframe and sort of to repeat how I understand your key argument to be is that we're really harnessing the power of the private sector to secure the availability of data to which we then provide access based on very elusive standards. So let me respond to that. And start with this idea that we are trying to balance the goals. We are trying to, at the same time, protect the rights of individuals and then secure some fundamental goals of law enforcement. And how do we go about that? So Joel talked a lot about the principle of proportionality, and it's one of the key general principles of law under the EU law. And when we look at the EU court's practices in working with this principle of proportionality, we see that sometimes they have been very deferential, and occasionally their review has been very intensive. And this is a particularly interesting one if we think about what is now on both sides of the equation here, is that the courts have been very deferential when the states are defending some practices with the view of protecting national security. The more important this goal is that they are trying to protect, the more important it is that the nation states have the discretion that they need. But at the same time, the review has been most intensive when it infringes upon fundamental rights. And this is what we talk about in privacy. So I think it is interesting to see where we find the course to settle on this one. But in the end, what we will have, as Joel noted, this will come down to how our national courts will also be interpreting this in light of the domestic criminal laws. We will be, by basically having less of a uniform European standard here, delegating more to the national states and national courts, we will gain something in retaining sovereignty, but we will lose something in terms of uniformity. There will be litigation that will ensue. We will have different, differing interpretations of proportionality, and that the different standards will come to dominate when we try to govern this balancing exercise. I think that's not ideal. I think that balancing is hard. But at the same time, I'm somewhat less concerned about this. This is what the European courts are very accustomed to handling, within privacy and outside of that. It basically, since its formation, the European Union has been trying to find this balance in preserving the member states some domestic policy space in pursuing their legitimate goals, while at the same time ensuring that they can create and strengthen the common market and have and offer harmonized protections to their citizens. So I guess that even though I see that there are these worries that the retention compromises this presumption of innocence, it may compromise the fundamental rights under the Charter, that is true, but I guess I have more faith in the ability of the European courts to balance those rights, and I have more faith in their inclination to uphold those fundamental rights. So I don't underestimate the challenge there, but I believe that European institutions and the courts and individual member states can rather well raise to that challenge, and over a relatively short time, I believe that they can find a balance that is workable, that is legitimate, that in the end will end in a relatively uniform standard across the member states. What I'm probably even more deeply concerned about is this idea of privatization of the state surveillance. This idea, what Joel says, that data retention transforms citizens into instruments of state power with respect to their fellow citizens. That's something Europeans are not used to. We don't have a tradition for that. That is very foreign to the idea that the European Union was built upon, and if we think about their legal framework more broadly. So even outside of privacy, in the areas where individual corporations would have and individual citizens would have clear enforcement incentives, the European Union doesn't grant them that opportunity. We talk about antitrust. Private suits are the norm in the United States. In the European Union, it is the Commission that still retains near monopoly in enforcing that. We see very few private antitrust suits at the European level. So the question is how we then would accept the idea that the private actors become responsible for something very different, something that involves potentially an infringement of the fundamental right of the Europeans. The state is understood as having the role to guarantee the fundamental freedoms and also then providing the security for the private citizens. That's not something that the state can delegate to private actors. And I think it goes to this fundamental question of how we structure societies. Where is the line between public and private? What's the relationship between the state and the market? And can we really re-evaluate or turn upside down our understanding of the role of the government as the guardian of these rights of the citizens and the provider of their security? So it's hard for me to see that the European Union would be comfortable in rethinking that respective role of the government and the individuals. So that takes me then to the broader question of why EU then thinks about privacy quite differently than the United States. So one is that there's a very different history that shapes the understanding of the privacy today, even in the EU. So we in the United States think about privacy more as a question of individual liberty, and we want to restrict the government's ability to compromise that. In the European Union, it is about fundamental rights. It's about protection of the dignity of the individuals. It also has historical roots. So ever since the World War II, the darkest period of the European history, we had examples of what can happen when we retain data and when that is misused. So that was when the Nazis, for instance, were using the Dutch national registries to identify Jews. That was the decision why about 72% of the Dutch Jewish people were able to be identified by the Nazis. Only 25% of the French Jews, because the French data retention was not that carefully done. So Europeans have still a very vivid memory of how things can go horribly wrong when the data collection is used for purposes other than that we consider even closely desirable. So one, that sort of the historical context is one that explains it. The second is that the view of the role of the government is generally very different in the EU. So the Europeans don't share the mistrust that the Americans have of the governments. EU rather looks at their governments as protectors of their fundamental rights. The mistrust in the Europe is more directed at markets. It's directed at corporations. If you look at sort of directly whether the Europeans mistrust internet companies, in the recent poll, 62% of the people say they do. They do not trust these companies with the data that they give to them. So a related concern is that the Europeans trust the governments. They don't trust the markets. They also then trust more regulation. They trust the ability of their governments to regulate, to intervene in the markets in a beneficial way. So when we think about the regulation, in the US what drives regulation more generally is this kind of cost-benefit analysis. Whereas Europeans are more driven by this principle of precaution. Let's regulate just in case. So when the US is more uncomfortable with this fear, more comfortable with the idea that the markets are self-correcting, US is much more fearful of the kind of false positives. The Europeans are fearful of false negatives. What happens if we fail to intervene when we should actually have intervened? So, and that's not limited to privacy. I think their privacy is very consistent with what happens across the other fields of law. This happens in antitrust. Maybe the most powerful example is from 10 years ago when the Europeans intervened and blocked the $42 billion merger between the two American companies, GE and Honeywell, after Americans had given green light to this merger. To me, it's a story of false positives and false negatives, what you're more afraid of. It's every day we see it in food safety, whether it's beef hormones, whether it's GMOs, whether it's chlorine-rinsed chicken. Europeans don't exactly know whether those are harmful, but just in case. We don't want to subject our citizens for that risk. So that leads me to the next point. When Europeans and the Americans have a different view, why is it that the European view prevails if we think about global commerce? It's no secret that Europeans like regulation, but why do we feel it so intensely in the United States as well? So when we think about global commerce, the global market, and at the same national standards, what we normally worry about is the kind of race to the bottom, that this dynamic of globalization would give countries the incentive to drive down their regulations. So that is one sort of finding of political science and our understanding of global markets. But that view also has been, if not discredited, but at least balanced with an alternative view. And that is what is known in the United States as a California effect. That sometimes we actually see that globalization leads us towards higher standard. The idea that there can be a most stringent regulator that alone is in a position to impose its regulatory preferences on others, as long as it has big enough of a market that the other players have an incentive to convert their entire production to the standard that prevails in that strict market. But if we look at this globally, we don't talk about California effect. California is rarely providing the global standards. Those standards normally come from Brussels, and that's why that is the phenomenon that I call the Brussels effect. And that is something that reaches across various areas, including the data protection, including privacy. So I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of what are the conditions under which we then see these rules to come from Brussels. What sort of explains that US, if US has its own view on privacy, why is it the EU view that predominates? So one is obviously that the size of the market. EU has 500 million consumers. It is very hard for any company to ignore the standards that prevail on that market. EU also has extensive regulatory capacity, and that capacity is only increasing now with the new data protection regulation that concentrates all the more power to the Brussels. What also makes EU very different from the US, so in terms of regulatory capacity, FTC doesn't match really the power of the Commission in this respect. But the EU also really has a preference for strict rules. That's the single key determinant. EU just wants to ramp up the regulatory level higher than the United States is willing to do. And that is one reason why the EU is the standard that you would need to convert to if you want to choose one standard globally to govern your activities. By deciding to comply with the most stringent standard, you can also ensure that you are in compliance with the standards elsewhere. But what is also key here is that you really need to make sure, if you think about the EU's ability to provide the global standards, that its standards are so-called non-divisible. That we talk about areas where the companies cannot choose to comply with EU standards with respect to their dealings with the EU, but then have more lenient standards in other markets. So if you can segment your production, then you can take advantage of lower standards in other markets. But in the areas of technology, it's often very different to always segregate where were these searches made. That European consumers might have been affected by these decisions. It's very hard to separate the markets in that sense, which is why many technology companies have decided that they are just better off to have a one global standard. And that global standard is often then the EU standard. So let's talk about the US reactions then. If the US doesn't like EU privacy rules, if the US doesn't like the Brussels effect, what can the US do about it? So let me first say that some in the US like the Brussels effect. So there are some in the United States that do not mind this idea that the EU's rules find their way all the way to the US. There are those who think that the US privacy regulation is not optimal. It's way too lenient. So we're quite happy that the European Union is doing some regulation where our own regulators fail to do that. There are also some small non-export-oriented corporations whose basically production is limited to the US market. They gain an advantage vis-a-vis their domestic competitors who have an export-oriented business who do need to undertake the cost of complying with the EU rules. So now, if you are only operating in the US market, you basically can get away with not complying to the US market and you are in a better position vis-a-vis your competitors. But many in the United States are concerned of what the EU is doing. There are those who say that this is really a threat to free speech. Jeffrey Rosen very recently characterized the new EU data protection regulation as being the biggest threat to free speech on internet in the coming decade. But a very pragmatic concern that often is voiced in the United States is that it just basically ramps up the compliance cost. It stifles innovation, and that uniform standard that is emerging in the European Union is just simply a standard that is too high and too costly to comply with. So there's very little that US can do about it, though, expect to express its displeasure with what the EU is doing. Markets don't really constrain the European Union here. EU gets away doing what it does. US could obviously enact even more stringent laws and become the global regulator, but that would take US only in the worst place and have basically endorse a policy that it prefers even less. What may happen is that the US may actually be more incentivized to cooperate. US may actually be, sort of contrary to its often sort of voiced inclinations against international cooperation, find that the only way really to have any say on privacy standards is to engage the EU. And let me sort of end, I'm running out of time, sort of with the one forum where this may happen. So in Obama's State of the Union address, he announced that America is interested in negotiating a free trade agreement with the European Union. This would be a huge deal. Those two economies together combined represent half the global economic output. It's one-third of the world trade flows. The biggest sticking point in the negotiations is the disagreements over standards, over regulations, over questions like privacy. U.S. has said we want privacy to be addressed there. We want mutual recognition. We want that the U.S. Privacy standards will be considered as adequate. EU has said that privacy is off the table. We will not negotiate that. But I believe that EU is, because of the Brussels effect, in a stronger position than the U.S. is in many ways. If U.S. doesn't take a deal, it's the EU standard that prevails. So one question is, why would EU ever give up its unilateral ability to set these standards? Normally, EU wouldn't. But these are not normal times for the EU. EU needs this deal. EU needs to basically hold on to the very few opportunities that are out there that can lift it from its economic struggles, that can provide it the boost and the growth. So I believe that there are both sides who really now need this deal, want this deal, and I think there is a possibility that privacy will be addressed there and we see some movement. EU may not come halfway, but it may come somewhere for a conversation.
Thank you very much, Anu. And now we'll hear from Kurt Wimmer.
Thank you. And Paul and the Berkeley Center, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here. There was a little bit of suspense around this conference, for Anu and me at least, because when we agreed to come out, Paul said, Joel will be writing something about European privacy. And we thought, terrific, of course we'll come. And then in the weeks before, I was thinking, well, what if Joel decides to write about, say, the right to be forgotten? I mean, could we really stand another 2 hours talking about the right to be forgotten? And so I was really thrilled to see that you'd written about data retention. I'd also say that, the times that I've seen events like this one where discussants sort of focus on an essay that's been written, it seems to be the most fun when people can really disagree. And I'm sorry to say that I really can't disagree. I think you've really gotten it right. I'm thrilled that you've written about data retention. As one government official in the EU said, it's the most privacy-invasive instrument ever adopted by the EU. I really do think that's right. So I'm going to focus on it just a little bit from the practitioner's perspective and talk a little bit about the sort of practical aspects, many of which Joel did talk about in his discussion. I was practicing in London on September 11th, 2001, which had a number of surreal aspects, but one of them was sort of watching this process roll out in real time. Just as quickly as the Patriot Act came together in the U.S., calls for greater law enforcement authority in the EU started to come about. We wrote at that time, 10 years ago, a paper for Privacy International, which is a European-based NGO, much like EFF, EPIC, CDT, really a terrific organization, focusing on how data retention schemes, mandatory data retention schemes, violated the European Convention. And that was published on Privacy International's website. And at the time, the House of Lords was considering a law in England that would impose mandatory data retention. And one of my colleagues, Dan Cooper, who some of us work with, made the mistake of going to listen to the hearing and was drafted as a witness and had to sort of testify. I mean, it was really an amazingly quick-moving time at the outset. One thing that I think is different in sort of having watched the development as opposed to looking back, I mean, we now look back at the 2006 directive, and it looks as if Brussels was pushing the rest of Europe to go in this direction. But in fact, at the time, each of the member states was independently adopting its own data retention scheme out of a response to the U.S. adopting the Patriot Act and this notion that, something had to be done. So you had a situation where Greek, Denmark, Austria, Spain, Belgium, and others had already passed laws on their own, and there was a divergence of approach in what had to be retained and how long it had to be retained. Greece was up to 3 years for a retention period, which is really intrusive. Industry, of course, was concerned about the patchwork quilt of regulatory requirements. How could you figure out, you know, what you have to do in Greece versus what you do in the UK versus what you do in Germany. And at the time, sort of think back 10 years, you know, storage is pretty cheap now. It was pretty expensive 10 years ago. So, you know, if you look at what it costs to maintain, you know, the amount of capacity that you would need to store 3 years' worth of data, it's pretty significant. So it was one of those rare moments when the interests of industry and the interests of the civil liberties community really kind of coalesced around an issue. Joel's paper does a real service by bringing the focus around to access, because, you know, the really pernicious item of this whole approach from the perspective of privacy and civil liberties is who can access the data and under what standard. I think the directive was really forced to delegate a lot of that authority to the member state just because questions of criminal procedure tend to be issues that are dealt with at the member state level in Europe. But at the same time, by not defining it, it allows the member states to really make some mistakes. You know, the directive talks about states accessing retained data for serious crime. But what really is serious crime? It's not just terrorism. It could be a number of other things. And again, I was looking at some research that Privacy International did recently. And here's the scoop in England. All police forces, intelligence, and security agencies can have access to retained data. 474 local authorities and 110 other public authorities can also have access to obtain communications data. And that's in a country the size of Massachusetts. And it's pretty extraordinary. There's a story of, and I'm not sure how true this is, but it's definitely a story of a council in Dorset in England in August 2010 allegedly using communications data to investigate whether a family lived in the right geographic area to send its kids to the school of that area, which isn't exactly a serious crime. I mean, so when you talk about mission creep, Joel, you're really exactly right. I also think the paper does a terrific job in laying out how data retention in the EU fits in with surveillance policy in the U.S. and how it fits in with European culture. I mean, as Anu described, the difference in approach between Europe and the U.S., it really is diametrically opposed. I and some of this is a cliche, but it's sort of, you know, the way that all cliches have a grain of truth. You know, in EU privacy regulation distrusts companies but trusts government. U.S. privacy regulation distrusts government but trusts companies. Data retention allows the trusted state to force compliance burdens for the surveillance it doesn't want to do itself on the company. So there's really sort of an evil genius element to this. And it also seemed to me that one of the reasons that data retention proposals really picked up steam was just the notion that it's really effective information to have. And, you know, you could think of a number of examples, but the one that always came to me was, you know, imagine an attack at a tube station or a coordinated attack at multiple tube stations. If you could just go to the telecommunications carrier, find out exactly what mobile phones accessed the cells in the regions around those tube stations, who was texting whom, and if it were coordinated, you know, where the recipients and the instigators of the communication were in contact with one another, you have a really good idea of who might be conspiring to commit those acts. The problem is, as you've said, is it's so over-inclusive. I mean, if there's an attack at the Canary Wharf tube stop and the Bond Street tube stop, you could very easily have a couple who happens to be working in those two areas communicating, and all of a sudden you look like terrorist suspects, and that's a very difficult bell to unring, which, you know, highlights one of the major problems problems with the proposal. I sort of see, sort of looking at Joel's schema, maybe three ways in which you might try to clarify and perhaps even unwind what's been done with data retention. The first is the one that Paul focused on and then one that we focused on 10 years ago with Privacy International, which is the European Convention. You know, in our view, indiscriminate data retention offends a core principle of the rule of law. Citizens should have notice of the circumstances in which a state may conduct surveillance so that they can regulate their behavior to avoid unwanted intrusions. That's just a core principle. It's about transparency and disclosure. It's virtually impossible to avoid electronic communications in modern life, And so all data subjects become surveillance targets, a result that really does, I think, violate Article 8 of the Convention. This is an area where the European Court wouldn't be writing on a clean slate. This has been dealt with before. The European Court struck down a mail surveillance law in Klass versus Germany, and Paul might be familiar with this from his work in Germany. Remember when people used to mail things to each other. This was, you know, a broad surveillance statute that allowed the mail to be read by authorities, and the European Court struck it down because it created a phrase I really like, a menace of surveillance, end quote, that struck at freedom of communications and thus interfered with the required respect for private life in Article 8. The key for me is that the state has to prove that a measure is essential for a democratic society for an interference to be upheld. And I think that's very hard to do with data retention because you can find ways to have particularized suspicions about people rather than sort of subject the entire population to surveillance. It's hard to see exactly how this ends up being upheld. The good news is if you went to the European Court in Strasbourg and attacked data retention, you could get a result that would not only apply in the 27 EU member states, but in all 47 signatory states to the European Convention. So it could have a very broad impact, which I think would be very beneficial because it's not just European countries that are adopting data retention schemes. But here's the problem. You know, the European Court is a very, very slow-moving institution. It's a little bit of a paper tiger. You know, if there's anything that's a pressing civil liberties issue, it's difficult to find redress in the European Court because it takes years. I mean, you've got to exhaust national remedies. Then you've got to have the right preconditions to sue the signatory state. I mean, it just takes a long time. And I've had cases where you're waiting for the decision for years on end, which in some areas is less problematic. I mean, freedom of expression, some places where that are sort of evergreen, it's not as problematic. But for privacy, for data retention, it's a long haul. Joel also mentioned member state courts, which I think is the second avenue for attack and probably the most promising one because it's in midstream. Joel described the excellent sort of dynamic in Germany where a German court has struck down the attempt to transpose the data retention directive as being inconsistent with German law. The German legislature has not then gone back and tried again, which is what's required, and the European Court of Justice has, and the Commission has referred it to the European Court of Justice. Helpfully, there are several others that are doing the same thing. There was a case in the middle of last year where Ireland referred a dispute to the European Court for the European Court of Justice on similar grounds. There was an attack on data retention, and the court in Ireland found that this may violate Irish law. Ireland and Slovakia were the two member states that voted against the directive. And more recently, national courts have ruled against the directive in Romania, Bulgaria, Cyprus, and the Czech Republic. Hungary has a pending challenge. Slovakia and Sweden are under review. So it's not exactly a revolution, but when 9 of your 27 member states, and when we started this process, actually, it was 15 member states, but when 9 of the 27 member states are pushing back and saying, you know, that principle is inconsistent with our domestic law, I think it's a productive route to a challenge. So the second route is the national courts. And finally, the third is data protection itself. I mean, Joel did a great job of sort of setting out how the very concepts underlying data protection are foreign to this notion of data retention. You know, the principle that's been a bedrock principle of European data protection law since 1995 when the direction was passed, but even before that as part of the OSCE guidelines, was data should be retained as long as it's necessary to satisfy the purpose for which it was collected, but not necessarily longer. And you could see how in the telecom sphere, telecommunications providers would keep records of phone numbers called as long as it was required to sort of prove that the billing was correct, and after that they'd get rid of them as there was no need to keep them. France is interesting because, you know, France for many years didn't have itemized phone records because it was thought to be intrusive of privacy because you could find out if someone was, if your spouse was having an affair by looking at the numbers that were dialed. That was problematic for some reason. So you have, I think, both procedural and substantive arguments under data protection. I think you've outlined in a really persuasive way how on the substance, just sort of the very bedrock principle, data retention and data protection are kind of at odds. The problem, of course, is that the concept that underlies data protection can always be changed. It's a legislative concept. Same legislature is dealing with it as is dealing with data retention. The more promising aspect, I think, is the procedural route, because as Anu mentioned, we're now in the context of Europe revamping its data protection landscape completely, sort of top to bottom. The slight variations between member states have been problematic in the views of many, so Europe is moving toward a regulation for data protection rather than a directive in which each member state passes a national law to enforce the directive. And when you have a regulation, it's really a very different dynamic. I have a partner who's sort of betting against the regulation ever happening because it really is sort of against the grain of the relationship that member states have had with the European Union on privacy. But it does change the dynamic. And so the e-privacy directive is due for a revamp. That's been postponed until after the regulation is passed, which is looking like 14 or 15. The same thing could happen with the data retention directive. And there was talk about mid-year last year, I guess, about postponing the relook at data retention until the regulation is passed. The good news is that sort of puts it on hold for a while. The bad news, of course, is that in most member states, it's already been transposed into law, so it's already there. So I think there are ways to go at it, and I hope that I do hope that some institutions do. On the U.S. side, I think Joel's paper underscores something really important about the global privacy debate. Sometimes you can sort of hear European regulators talking about the American scheme and saying, you know, how dangerous it is for cloud computing, for example, for Americans to be in the business because the Patriot Act could require us to disclose data about European data subjects. And if you sort of parse through that and go back and look at the European laws that apply to accessing data, again, focusing on access, as Joel did, there are a number of European national laws that allow access to this data without a warrant, without court process, without informing the data subject. If anything, I think the U.S. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the Patriot Act, as you might imagine, but if anything, U.S. law is at least as protective as most European law. So the question is really, does this concept of data protection cross the Atlantic? I mean, Joel's pointed out that American business does retain a lot of data on consumers. So, you know, it's possible that if you had this sort of access scheme, maybe government takes advantage of all the data that's being collected about consumers and then can mine that for purposes of figuring out, for purposes of solving crime. I guess I'm hopeful that we won't see that approach coming across simply because I don't think there's a lot of, I mean, politically, I don't think there's a lot of appetite for new anti-terrorism laws. One more major incident and all bets are off. I mean, I can't predict what might happen if you had another 9/11. I mean, God forbid. But, you know, it doesn't seem likely. On the other hand, we do have a situation here where the National Security Agency has been amassing an enormous amount of data about telephone calling information, text messages, emails, web browsing. So, you know, perhaps the answer is we don't need it because we've already been doing it. And the government's in control of it. But if you look at why the NSA put together this database, it's looking for patterns. It's trying to tie people together, figuring out who's communicating with whom. The data that American business tends to pull together is more likely to be data about what an individual is doing. I mean, a lot of the data that's collected is advertising-related data because, you know, companies want to serve you more useful ads. So, you know, cookies, tracking cookies, flash cookies, web pixels, all this behavior that's being tracked through cookies can disclose relationships, can disclose, and if you're looking at, you know, who's been looking at websites about the precursors for certain explosives, you can get at it that way. But the kind of core data about who's talking with whom is sort of less likely to be contained within the data that U.S. business, you know, tends to pull together. I was going to talk a little bit about Clapper versus Amnesty International just because it just happened on Tuesday, but I see that I'm out of time. So I'll hold on that and hope someone asks a question.
Work that into the period of questions. Look, why don't we give Joe a chance to respond, and then we'll open up the discussion to the audience.
I think I'm going to do it in the reverse order. I'm going to start with something, Kurt, you had just said about the data protection law itself. Which was, you made it as an offhand remark, but I'm going to pick up on it. It's just statutory and it can change. That actually has been a shift in Europe because now data protection, data privacy is in the charter. So it's been elevated to the equivalent of a constitutional right in Europe, which I think would make it much harder to affect any kind of change at that point. And that, I think, may have some very interesting bleedovers into some of the other areas that you were talking about. Especially, I was fascinated by the observation, I hadn't done the math, that 9 out of 27 member states have pushed back on the retention side. Not much discussion, I don't know if there's as much, and I haven't seen it, on the national access rules, because right, those rules don't wind up going up to the court.
Right. Yes, that's exactly right.
Those are and that's really where the rubber hits the road in this case. Yeah. It's, you know, what's it going to take? You mentioned as well that there are member states with Patriot Act equivalents that provide for warrantless access to privately held data. So those sorts of rules, just no one really knows what they are or how they operate on the ground. And to me, that's an incredibly troubling problem, because the moment you have anything obligating retention and you don't begin to delve deeply into those type of rules, and those type of rules, as we've seen, they're not going to percolate up to the EU level. Unless now, and maybe we'll see this, unless these rules begin to get challenged as a violation of the Charter of Fundamental Rights. And this will be new because the Charter's only been in effect for a couple years now. So given the time lag, we may see more of it. I do think, though, I can't recall which one of the two of you had mentioned this, on a proportionality analysis in an EU court or in the court of European Court of Justice, so it could be either at a member state level or the European Court of Justice, I think it's going to be extremely difficult for the court to resist the public safety arguments. Mm-hmm. Even though, and this was fascinating, I think, with Anu, something you had said, that traditionally the EU Court of Justice will give deference to the member states where it deals with public security, but stricter scrutiny, that's probably not equivalent to American strict scrutiny, but a closer scrutiny when it deals with fundamental rights. And in these cases, we're smack in the middle of it, right? Because on the one hand, the whole argument that the member states make and the rationale that we have the retention directive pushed by the public safety ministries. It's pushed by the interior ministries. So there it's anchored in public security, which gets deference, but it's implicating a fundamental right, which gets a greater level of scrutiny. And I think when you look at the court trying to balance this out, it's either going to, I mean, I don't think they're going to be able to find a sweet spot in the middle. They're either going to give the deference to the security apparatus, or they're going to strike down the security apparatus, and then we're left with a public safety problem. So I think finding that, calling it proportionality and finding it proportionality is going to be extremely difficult to reach any kind of balance that can actually work. And let me make, I guess I can make one more comment that I thought this was interesting, to kind of link the Brussels effect that Anu, you were speaking of, to the data retention access situation. Because in the Brussels effect, you sort of see it at several levels. I think you were talking a little more and quite appropriately so, in the general EU privacy context and how EU privacy law plays out in the rest of the world and as compared to the United States. But in the retention access area, I'm not sure that can work. And I'll give two examples, passenger name records and SWIFT. Mm-hmm. Right, the passenger name record case is one just a couple years ago where the Homeland Security required every airline, European airline,
to provide the passenger record information. So it tells who you're traveling with, how you paid for your ticket. It gives some religious information depending on your meal choices. There's a lot of information in there. That has to be provided to the U.S. authorities, or else the American threat was the plane's not going to land in the United States. Europe, in effect, totally caved and permitted that information to be, that access to that information be provided to the Americans in a way that they couldn't do it within Europe. It would violate European law to give the same information to within member state authorities. The Swift case was another similar case. There was, I think it was Customs Border Protection, sought access to SWIFT. SWIFT is the European Interbank Money Transfer System. It's based in Brussels. They sought access to the data of money transfers. They wanted a direct line to global money transfers. And SWIFT, as an organization, gave the access to the Americans. It became public. SWIFT is a private corporation in Brussels subject to the Belgian data privacy statute. I don't think anybody kind of seriously could argue that what SWIFT did was legal under Belgian law. Yet at the political level, they had to compromise and decide retroactively it was going to be okay. So in that sense, here you have two very powerful American requests for access to information that in substance violate the disclosure to the responding to those access requests by giving disclosure to the U.S. authorities pretty clearly violated the local European laws. Yet, instead of the Brussels effect, it was the Washington effect. Access was granted. And here again, in the retention access, I don't know how strong the appetite would be in other parts of the world to have the same kind of balance that's taking place in Europe. Because to the extent that your access rules are wedded to your notions of due process and your notions of constitutional rights, those rights are not going to look the same in Argentina and Brazil and Colombia and Saudi Arabia and Southeast Asia, where there has been great interest in the general European data protection model. So I think that's going to be something very interesting to see how that plays out.
Interesting. Thank you very much. Why don't we see if we have some questions from the audience, and we have a microphone to pass around. James, it's Jim Rule, and I should add that when Joel and I were talking in 1992 and saying, well, there's only two of us, actually we found out quickly there was at least a third person, a pioneer in our field, Jim Rule, a social scientist.
But I'm not a lawyer, and so
we'll forgive you.
I have a different take on a lot of the things that's being discussed, because although I agree it's true that the language of the legal traditions concerning personal data on the two sides of the Atlantic are different, the differences seem more superficial to me than I think you let on. And there's some of the statements that I heard really leave me scratching my head. Does the United States, for example, really trust companies but not governments? Now, this is, what, two or three days after the Supreme Court decision that basically made it impossible for interested private parties to challenge or even look into what governments are doing with communications data, for example. 2 days. How quickly does the memory machine work in a case like this? If you look at both sides of the Atlantic, from a non-lawyer's point of view, you see certain parties with predictable interests. Companies desiring to make more money by knowing more about their would-be customers. And governments desiring to reach more deeply into private life in order to enhance the security efforts that we all know about. The extension of retention times under the third European directive that Joel discussed was a direct result of the 9/11 events. It was pressed by all accounts by American interests, but it was accepted without serious opposition by the EU, and it's of course being incorporated into EU law with greater and lesser degrees of reluctance. Joel, in the main part of his talk, talked almost exclusively about commercial recourse to communications data as an evidence of privacy embarrassments. And I absolutely concur in that, but nobody knows, either in this country or in Europe, the extent of the other kind of recourse, which is what actually drove this process in both places, and that is the desire of the government security establishment to reach more deeply into private life and to know and to monitor communications and communication patterns without probable cause, simply in the desire to identify something that might, in retrospect, look suspicious. Does that make you concerned about privacy values? I hope so. Why emphasize the differences when the similarities are so gaping?
Joe, would you like to respond?
Sure. Let me start with your question, does the U.S. really trust companies but not the government? I think the answer to that is no, we don't really trust companies that significantly either. But as our legal system sets up, I think our legal system operates with a presumption that, in the United States at least, that we need to be protected against the government more than anything else. I mean, if we look at the Bill of Rights, for example, it's a protection against overreaching by the state. We've seen, and we see this in a lot of the public opinion polls associated with the online activities, that there is a growing and deeper skepticism now of corporate behavior than we ever saw before. In terms of the similarities between the security apparatus on each side of the Atlantic delving into information about individuals and their private activities, I think that's absolutely right. I think that there is great interest in both sides. I think that gets to, in part, and I will freely admit it was beyond the initial scope of what my research to try to learn about the intricacies of how that takes place. In the United States, we see it through provisions in the Patriot Act. We see it in a way very different in the U.S. than what we would in Europe. So, for example, we have fusion centers in the United States. Fusion centers are federally funded operations that are data centers in various parts around the country, where the government the government agencies collect information about individuals largely from the private sector. They buy it on the commercial marketplace and stick it in a database and try to mine it for activity. That type of construction of a database, I think, by and large, would not be possible under European laws as they exist today. Now, whether there are all sorts of national security exceptions in individual countries, I just don't know enough about it to really delve into it just yet.
Do we have more questions? Yes. We've got a microphone coming around.
Well, thank you for a great discussion. You discussed about differences and disagreements between two worlds. And it seems to me there is a lot going on in Washington. Corporations in the business world trying to address privacy concerns by doing a lot of work with privacy compliance, and there's a lot done on that arena. My question is very practical. What we as individuals can do to influence the process, and what has been done and can be done in the academic world to move us forward to some balance and compromise?
Great question. And we can go to the rest of the panel for that, too.
I think Kurt from Washington is probably the best. I'll give a very quick answer. Make campaign contributions. That's probably the most important thing we can do in Washington today.
Sad but true. I do think it's been very interesting from a Washington perspective to watch the legislative process in privacy. I would have thought before the 2010 elections, that we were coming very close to having legislation on privacy, at least on tracking, at least on kids. And then the election in 2010 was a sea change. I mean, there were more new members in 2010 than in any election since 1994. So it doesn't just mean that the committees change. It means that you've got a lot of people who never thought about privacy who are now sitting on the oversight committees that have to think about these things. And so you have people like Mary Bono Mack who, you know, had not done it before and now was sharing this committee with this enormous responsibility in the House. Took her a while to get up the learning curve, and then wham, another election, more new people. She was not reelected, but more new people in leadership. So it's a long, slow process. I do think there's pretty likely to be legislation, you know, not this year probably, but maybe toward the second half of this Congress and perhaps the next Congress, you know, as things creep along. But it's long and slow. I do think, though, you mentioned academic support. Privacy is probably the only area I can think of where academic principles have really had an enormous impact on how public policy looks at privacy. I mean, the whole concept of looking at privacy as contextual, you sort of trace that back, you know, to the Nussbaum book. I mean, the concept of privacy by design, which really sort of took root, all these concepts that have come out of policymakers, academia, and the intersection have really had a huge impact. So if there's an area where the people at this table, except me, are really making a lot of impact, it's in the thinking about these approaches and coming up with paradigms that I think are going to make their way into law.
Anu, did you want to?
No, just a brief comment. I think my colleagues who write distinctly about privacy, I write more about general EU law, but colleagues like Joel and Paul do a great service also by bringing to the U.S. debate the comparative perspective. That basically invites us to rethink that we don't need to have a privacy in the sort of narrow set of parameters that the conversation has been about the U.S. privacy alone. The question about what can you do as a citizen, and one question is what you can do in terms of lobbying in Washington. I think sort of build on my earlier remarks, lobby Brussels as well. That's where the U.S. companies resisting privacy regulation have landed and are investing heavily. So I think we want to have the counter forces as well from the United States, because some of the battles are fought there when the outcomes are felt here.
Could I throw in a couple?
Yeah, please.
I was going to say, I think that the bootstrapping is really essential here. I think there's much greater resonance to the citizens' perspective on privacy in Brussels than there typically is in Washington. But it also suggests to me that an avenue for citizens is to address corporations. Because unless large corporations see it as being in their interest, nothing's going to happen on Capitol Hill. And to the extent that, and we've seen this, we've seen some very significant changes in companies over the years. Take Microsoft, for example. If you look at Microsoft and what they were doing in privacy 10 or 15 years ago, the original defaults, for example, that they had set in Microsoft Explorer were atrocious when it came to privacy. They were adamantly opposed. They were big proponents of self-regulation. Right. Now you fast forward 15 years later, they're looking at privacy as a business strategy and as a competitive tool. And they've made a very significant change in how they treat privacy. And I think that's come in part from who their customers are. So to the extent that as individuals we can really push back, that pushback, I think, will have a positive effect in the way the companies deal with their lobbying, both in Washington and Brussels. And I want to pick up on something that Kurt said, because I think, how many of you are law students in the room? Oh, this is great. Okay, so this is really just you. Kurt just said something. If you've seen all the debate recently about the Supreme Court justices that say law review articles are never read, right? It's totally meaningless. The academy is just out to lunch. What Kurt just said is so important, which is in the privacy world, it's one of those areas, this stuff is not happening in the courts. What we're dealing with here, it's not in the courts. It's happening at the policymaking level. And it's happening in the regulatory agencies in the United States in front of the FTC, for example, or the FCC. It's happening in the halls of Congress. And who are those people looking to? Right? They're looking to thought leaders. They're looking to what's being written in the legal literature, in the social science literature. So it's an area where it's new, it's this fusion of policy and theory in a way that we just don't see in many other places in American law right now.
So if you're in law school now, this is a great area to think about doing your student notes in and in writing in, because people will actually listen.
So I can add two things, and then we'll call on Susan Fryworld. One of the things that we try to do, Kurt, as you know, the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology is actually reach out to the EU, reach out to practitioners and other academics. And so we'll be having, just a little plug here, an event on March 21st in Silicon Valley, to which everybody's invited, where we present our scholarship, but in a kind of reality community-friendly way. So there'll be short presentations and then responses by practitioners and in-house attorneys. And then we'll be having the Privacy Law Scholars Conference here in June. And so I should give a big shout-out to Chris Hufnagel, who's our Director of Privacy Operations here at BCLT, and who actually talks to people in the real world. And then the second thing I would say, in terms of, you know, your question was about what can people do, I think a very important strategy for U.S. companies, and there are some of you here today, and people, whether representing the civil liberties perspective in the U.S. or whatever perspective you are, is reach out to young EU scholars, reach out to the people now who are going to law school and writing their doctorates, and educate them. Because I've actually seen a sea change in going over to Europe, where there's definitely a more kind of doctrinally driven older generation, and then a younger generation. It takes, of course, forever in Europe to become a professor compared to the U.S. So I've gone from being, you know, the impossibly young professor in the room to no longer being, you know, the young professor, which means, I guess, that I've been a professor forever plus. But it's the young professors that the U.S. companies and the firms and the government and everybody in the U.S. should be identifying now, because they just view the world differently. Not necessarily better, but differently. A quick illustration of that. So in Munich, I spoke in the fall at the German Jurist Day, which is a biannual event, and it was about privacy law. And the minute I landed in Munich, I let various people know who were involved in the conference that I was there and everything was okay. So I show up the next day and I tell the various people, oh, yeah, I'm here. And one of them said, well, I was very worried whether or not you were going to make it. And I said, well, I emailed you from the airplane as soon as we landed. And she or he said, oh, that went to my email back home. Right, in another part of Germany. And I guess I'll get that when I get home to my email. So it was like, okay, well, this is kind of a different worldview about, you know, the World Wide Web. And, you know, so keep writing those articles, because that helped. So that would be, anyway, that would be my second point, that it's very important on the U.S. side to start bringing in some of the relatively younger scholars. Okay, Susan.
Thank you. This has been really interesting and informative. I just wanted to push on one point that I feel like you've covered, but maybe could cover a little bit more. And that's the question of whether or not the U.S. government has more access to cloud data with less process than is true in Europe. And I know Kurt brought that up, and Anu talked about it as well. And I know it's a part of the U.S. position. The Department of Commerce has taken this position, and U.S. companies are taking the position that, in fact, it's not true that the U.S. government has greater and easier access to cloud data than in Europe. But I have the suspicion that when we make that comparison, what we're doing is comparing the official law on our books, which has some protections, with the unofficial practices over in the EU. And particularly, Anu said that, you know, for national security purposes, information is shared. Well, if we're going to talk about sharing over here for national security purposes, we should talk about all the stuff that goes on behind closed doors with the NSA, et cetera. And then we could compare apples and apples, and then I think it would probably be a different story. So if we could compare the official U.S. policy under which, post-Patriot Act, but even before, law enforcement has very easy, non-warrant access to quite a lot of information in the cloud, and compare that to the official policies over in Europe, particularly with the proportionality principle, my sense is that the Europeans protect their data much better. And I'm wondering if Anu wants to speak to that again, or Kurt, if you have specific examples where European countries actually protect it less, or if Paul or Joel want to weigh in.
Sure.
Well, I could point you, in terms of specific examples, there's a really excellent paper that Hogan Lovells did that's on the law firm website, published in May of 12, I guess. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's helpful to know. I read well to me. But you know you make a really valid point, which is there's law that's on the books, and then there's what's actually happening. And we talk about the Patriot Act, but you know, what's the FISA court doing, and how can you find out about it, and where are the secret dockets? And there are secret dockets. So, you know, I think the point that you make is valid in terms of national security interests. I do think that the European side is overblowing the differences because of competitive concerns. I mean, there's this notion that, data collected by the United States in the United States is unsafe. I think as to data being collected on someone who has a reasonable, who the state reasonably suspects is involved in a terrorist activity, any country in the world is giving that data up. And I think that's just the cold reality that we're in. But I do think it's a little bit disingenuous for Europe to sort of say, we've got all this procedure and the United States has none. But, you know, reasonable minds could differ.
No, I mean, it's just sort of a little bit like related comment. I don't have a direct example that would better illustrate this point. But the idea of when we talk about serious crimes, the definition of the boundaries within which when then we strike the balance in a way, that I think there's a very different world when in the EU you are trying to access the data to try to prove whether somebody's going to a different school district. I think you'd be very confident taking that case and winning it either in Luxembourg or Strasbourg. So in the end, there is a law, if challenged, that will give us the kind of outcome in the enforcement where we can be very sure of like where the law stands. The question is whether all those will be fought and challenged. But in the end, there's a law that provides you a path to challenge that. And there, if it comes to that, ultimately who will arbitrate those, I think we will know how the principle of proportionality is decided upon. And there, I think, goes a little bit to, if I may, to Joel's earlier point that when we think about this level of scrutiny, that where we end up is that we will draw a distinction as to whether we do this because of terrorism or whether we do it for lesser crime. And I think that's in the end that will be the sort of the factual inquiry in Europe, that we will see probably much more willingness to recognize the legitimate right to access the data, assuming we talk about the most serious of the crimes, including the terrorism, but not so when it comes to something that is somewhere between the school districts and a proper crime, but nothing close to a severe one.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the kind of answer that it warrants is extremely complex one, because I'll pick up on a news point. The definition of the serious crime is going to happen at each of the member state levels, and at each member state that answer, what's brought within that scope is likely to be different. And I think that what you're highlighting is if you look at, I think you need to have two inquiries, official law to official law. In the U.S., it's a lot easier because we're really dealing with, by and large, federal law. In Europe, you're dealing with 27 sets of laws. So to compare 27 to 1, it's going to make it, you know, what happens if Romania apparently is terrible, but France and Germany are good? You know, how are you going to weigh that? The second level, though, is I think you also have to make a different inquiry, which is impossible for us as scholars to do, which is look at reality to reality. Because I think you may have law on the books, but look what happened at 9/11. Right? We had ECPA on the books that protected communications data. The telephone companies didn't wait for warrants or subpoenas. They answered the phone and, you know, turned over everything in the 24 hours following the attacks. Now, was it the right thing to do? I sure am glad they did it. Was it legal to do? Probably not. Congress changed the law to retroactively immunize them for having done it. But, you know, so you've got reality to reality. I would say the inquiry there is, you know, okay, so there will be a reality that, as we've seen in the United States with the GAO reports and all of the analyses of whether or not the proper procedures are being followed for the NSL letters and the warrants and so forth, and the answer is always essentially no. The violations are quite stark. So if that's the reality, then the question I would want to know is how, what's the norm? Right. The reality is the laws are going to be breached. How rampant are those breaches, and why, under what circumstances are they being breached? If they're being breached because you've just had the largest single attack on your country, and in a 12-hour period after, people are paying a lot less attention to the legal niceties, that's one thing. But if it's because you're interested in the bedroom habits of an IMF chief, you know, you may have a different take on how far you're willing to allow breaches to occur.
Yes.
First of all, thanks for a great debate. I was just wondering, the U.S. and the EU are the most prominent players in the privacy realm. But I'm wondering whether other countries like China or the Middle East should be invited into this important dialogue. And I know probably there the concern is more of a censorship rather than privacy. But if we were to invite those countries, how would that take place, and how could we spark a global dialogue about these questions?
Great question. Joe, would you like to start?
Sure. It's a terrific question. If we look at some other part, let's take China and the Middle East. I'll start with the Middle East. Israel is the only country in the Middle East with data privacy regulation and regime. They have a privacy statute. They have an oversight body. They've been dealing, and their court system has been dealing with precisely this issue. Now, they probably grant far broader access than we would accept in the United States, but they've been in a perpetual state of war. China doesn't have a data privacy regime like what I was describing, and there, I think my limited knowledge of China is you have an access regime instead. The state is able to find out an awful lot and is able to censor an awful lot as part of it. As China has opened up more, there have been greater discussions about having some kind of, I don't want to call it quite a Western-style privacy rule, but there has been some discussion. Hong Kong, for instance, has a data protection law, and when Hong Kong became part of China, that law remained. It was not voided out. So it's certainly something that it'd be very interesting to hear those perspectives. They're different from what we think of. They're also not in China and in parts of in the Middle East other than Israel. They're not democracies, and the data privacy regimes that we've been talking about are really privacy regimes that are part of the democratic enterprise.
You know, Anu mentioned this. There's sort of an arms race for the countries that don't have privacy laws, and, you know, our Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Commerce are sort of proselytizing our view, which is you have these sector-specific laws, and the Europeans have been extremely effective at proselytizing their view that you've got this overarching law that applies across the board to many things. And, you know, clearly the Europe side is winning because, frankly, our side is sector-specific. It's complicated. It looks idiosyncratic. The European side looks very kind of comprehensive. You've got one set of procedures and set of principles that apply across the board to online, offline, other types of transactions. So, you know, in Latin America, you're seeing the European model dominantly. You know, Israel has a European model. In fact, they're one of the few countries that actually has a finding of equivalence from the EU that so they can transfer data. So I do think there is an emerging sort of international dialogue about privacy law. It will be very interesting to see what happens when Europe goes to 2.0. You know, when Europe is, you know, sort of takes its approach and makes it what I think will be a much more sort of forceful regulatory approach with the data protection regulation. You'll then have a lot of countries that followed them when they were a data protection directive system that probably won't say, well, let's, you know, Europe did 2.0, let's go do 2.0 ourselves. So you'll have these different regimes. China is interesting. I think Joel's exactly right. I mean, it's more, you know, access by the state, although they're now taking sort of baby steps toward coming up with privacy regulations, most of which seem pointed at being able to sort of facilitate surveillance by the state. But, you know, I think there is a greater focus on international interoperability of privacy laws and you know, sort of driven by companies, because you may have a need to have data processed in the Philippines, for example. So it might be very much in the interest of the Philippines to come up with a data protection regime that might be more interoperable with Europe. So I do think there are certain core principles that are becoming more accepted, and it's dominantly because of the European approach.
Can I quickly comment on that? Why EU has been more successful generally, sort of entrenching its norms, not just through the markets like with the Brussels effect, but also just sort of making sure that countries that do adopt domestic laws, that they are more they're modeled again according to the EU law. So one is that the way the EU writes its legislations, it already needs to accommodate a lot of diversity. It already writes the regulations with the view that there is a process where 27 countries need to, and in the end, sign up on those. So in the end, all those considerations of different preferences are part of the legislation, and when those differences are voiced in conversations with other countries, the European Union is often already prepared to come up with a modification of why this also does accommodate your interest. So that's one. The second that applies, to my knowledge, a little less to privacy, but generally to regulation, and I'd be curious to see whether EU will sort of, when it's sort of ramping up its arms race, will use this tool. EU often requires the EU-style regulation as a condition for a trade agreement with the EU. US doesn't do that. So in all its preferential trade agreements, you can only do that with the EU if you take a set of EU laws as a model there. And then because EU in its privacy law has an explicit requirement that it refuses the transfer of data to the countries that does not adequately protect the data. Well, if you copy your law according to the European law, you are sure to meet the standard that you have adequate protections. So there are many incentives embedded there. EU obviously has an even greater sphere of influence across the region that is closer to the European Union. Those countries that do want to have a closer accession, sort of path to accession to the EU ultimately. So they are already, long before they get to the point that they are considered for membership, they are rewriting their laws to basically conform closely to the laws of the EU.
Wonderful. I think we have time for one more question. Yes, please.
For young scholars, and I'm an almost law student starting next fall, and I'm just curious as to, in order to effectively navigate this space, this privacy landscape, what type of technical knowledge do you suggest, like, someone that wants to get into this field start to brush up, get up to speed on, just things like big data and cloud storage and I'm learning as much as I can, but I know that I want to work in this area and want to be an effective leader in this space.
Why don't we start with Kirk, because he actually gives people's jobs.
Well, you know, the short answer is, I think it's important to enjoy technology and to sort of feel comfortable with it. I don't think it's necessary to necessarily, you know, have a computer science background, but if you do, I mean, that's fantastic, because a lot of, you know, what you do in terms of privacy work, at least from the advisory side, is pretty granular, and, you know, knowing how systems work is a good thing. But, you know, I think the best way to get up to speed is, you know, if you happen to be an engineering major undergrad, that's great, but it's too late to sort of go back and do that, and it certainly was too late for me. I was not an engineering undergrad. I think just having an openness toward technology and sort of keeping up with what's going on a lot of the current debates, I mean, there are some policy issues that arose out of very arcane inspections of how web surfing works, for example. I mean, Ashkan Soltani and others are great at sort of parsing through exactly what's happening, you know, within a header, within within the do not track. So I think just keeping up to speed on what's going on is a good way to do it. And in your legal education, you'll probably have an opportunity to delve into technology a little bit as you write and as you select classes.
Joe, did you get the last word?
Sure. I'll throw in. I think those are great observations. I think in keeping up to speed, there are two components to it. One is to just be aware of how the technologies are evolving, what's being used. But in becoming aware, the second aspect of that is look under the hood from time to time. Right? You don't need to be a computer scientist, but unpack it. Like, pretend it's a Lego set and, like, take it apart. You know, do what you can to understand, you know, walk through your different Facebook privacy settings. Look at your cookies, you know, whatever the equivalent is 5, 10, you know, the next couple of years. Look at them. Look at what the technologies are doing under the hood so you have a sense of it. You don't have to know enough to be able to write it, but you have to be able to play with it to sort of, you know, like playing around to see what it does. And that's going to really help you understand what the law and policy implications are. Or it will, if not there, it'll help you make connections between what you see going on under the hood and what you see as some legal or policy aspect.
Thank you very much. And Joe, thank you so much, and our commentators for a wonderful evening session. So we're going to have, before everybody gets up, we're going to have a short presentation from Robert Barr. Surprise for Joe.
Yes. Well, first, I just to make sure everyone heard what Paul said, we are having a couple privacy events coming up. On the back table, there are flyers for the Privacy Law Forum. There are also flyers describing and promoting Paul's book, Privacy Law Fundamentals. On our website, you can find information on upcoming events. You can also find Joel's slides from today.
And we want to thank Google.
And thank you, Google, for sponsoring the event. Our LinkedIn group, join our LinkedIn group, Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. And we'd like to present Joel this award, which in appreciation of presenting the lecture.
And we'll hold it up. Yay, Joel.
Thank you, Joel.
Cool.
And we even have a box for the event, for the award. And for protecting our privacy, we want to protect you from the rain.
Thank you.
Happens
Thank
to
you.
Have a BCLT logo
Thank you.
On it.
Thank
but,
you.
I think that's it. Did I cover everything? And thank you all for coming, and please stay for the reception, the food is in the sunroom. Everyone's pointing. Thank you, Julia and Louise, for helping with the event, and Claire. And the reception food and drink is through those doors. I guess we'll move the chairs so people don't all have to stay in that room. But thank you all very much.
Thank you.